Hello, and welcome to The Leap of Faith. In a week that's seen the publication of the final report of the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes, confirming that about 9,000 children died in the 18 homes examined. Shortly, I'll speak with Mary Steed, born in Besborough in Cork, who is among the thousands of babies and children sent for adoption to the United States from the 1940s to the 1960s. We'll also hear from Alison O'Reilly, the journalist who first broke the story of the Tomb Baby scandal in 2014. But first, a poem written in 2017 by Mary Coll, who joins me now from her home in Limerick. Mary, your poem, published in a collection Silver, has gotten a lot of attention.
It did, Michael. It was quite surprising. It's a poem about my own experience of being born in one of the mother and baby homes in Castle Pollard in County Westmeath. And it's called Laundry, and it was published in a collection called Silver, as you said, by Ireland House. And then it was in the Irish Times that year on Saturday. And then it kind of, you know, sank like most poems do into the back shelves of everything. And someone shared it, a friend of mine shared it this week, and it just took off. It went, I suppose you could say, viral. It was shared extensively across Twitter, across Facebook, across Instagram. And I was overwhelmed by the responses. It seemed to touch people in a very personal way. People had a very visceral and immediate response to it. And I think timing in life is everything, and the timing seemed to be right.
Well, Mary, will you read it for us and then we'll talk a little more?
Laundry. My grandfather sent everything to the nuns for a thorough cleaning, including my mother. Fervently, they washed every stain away. Hold us up to the light so there's hardly a trace of me left in her or her left in me. Things are forever getting separated in the wash. A fawn silk stocking, a tiny pink sock with no matcher. The price to be paid for getting your laundry done.
What is your story?
I was born in Castle Pollard, one of the many mother and baby homes, in 1962. My mother was a young woman from County Limerick, and she was brought there having gone to the local doctor because she wasn't feeling well. She was very surprised to discover that she was pregnant. She was from a much more innocent and naive time than we're living in now. As I learned afterwards, the GP called her father and the parish priest, which seems quite shocking. Almost incomprehensible. And in the dead of night, she was bundled into a car and away from home, away from everybody she knew. And she was in Castle Pollard until a few months after I was born. And then she was told by her family that she was to tell nobody. She was to buy herself some nice clothes in Dublin, and she was to come back home. And if anyone asked, she'd been in London visiting family, and she was, you know, decked up to the nines with the new clothes, and she was never to talk about it again. And pretty much I understand that she didn't talk about it again, which is a really, really hard thing to imagine for me as a mother with two kids, that you would have to hold something so painful inside. So the poem, while it's quite short, it kind of took me my whole life to write it. And in it, I tried to put, I think all my feelings and thoughts and comments, attitudes, reflections, all the pain, all the anger, everything for two generations, for her and for me, into something. And then it was done. I had said what I needed to say.
Did you get to make contact again?
Yes, we met once many years ago. It's a very frustrating, anyone who's been through this process will tell you, it's a terribly frustrating process. In my case, I was dealing with what I would describe as resistant social workers who didn't want to progress my search. And when I finally did meet her, I was overwhelmed. She was overwhelmed. Nothing can prepare you for that kind of meeting. So a lot of it passed in a blur. I wasn't even really able to recall things that she said to me. I came out afterwards and I said to my husband, I've got brothers and sisters. And he said, how many? I said, I'm not sure. I can't remember what she said, because it just hits you like a tsunami. And then it was over before I had time to process it, I think, properly. And then the next time I saw her was the night that she died, when she was laid out at home in her house. And Her husband, who was a wonderful man, he was not my birth father, called me to tell me she had died and invited me to come to the house. And that night I met my two sisters and my four brothers, my six half siblings, in the strangest possible way. And they couldn't have been kinder or more welcoming. And the past kind of fell away in many ways. And the barriers that the state and its institutions had put up to stop us from connecting with each other were gone. And we all just got on with our lives very, you know, normal, as any family does, you know. And I have to say, Michael, I had a charmed life, you know. I was adopted by the most extraordinarily wonderful couple. I was an only child, which suited me perfectly because I was the centre of everybody's attention. And I like to think I've remained that way. I was quite privileged in my upbringing and had every advantage that could have been given to me. But the most important thing I had was I had incredible love. And so for me, it was a happy journey. But it's always a journey with a shadow over it. You know, you just, everybody wants to know who they came from, who they are, who their people are, where is that place that your roots are. And even though you belong to the places that you set up yourself, you just need to know. And it's a fundamental human right.
But even when you read and hear you read the poem to us, that there's still a sting in it. There should be,
because, you know, nobody asked my mother if she wanted to go to a mother and baby home. Nobody asked her if she wanted to keep me. Nobody. And she talked, when I met her that day, she talked about what Castle Pollard was like. She talked about the hunger, the physical hunger, the shame, the hardship, the endless hard tasks and labour that she did, the polishing of the floors, the carrying of the buckets of water. I mean, you know, those movies that you saw, they weren't made up. She did hard work while she was pregnant with me. And she had no contact from any of her family except a brother who used to write to her and send her some money. Her brother Liam was very good to her. And her parents just shut it all down. I mean, there was no choice. And she said to me that day that she was polishing the wood on the banisters of the stairs when the nun came to her with me and said, "Say goodbye to your baby now, Brita." And that was it. No lead up, no preparation. And I was gone and she was gone. And I wasn't a small baby. I mean, I was 3 months old. So you know how a bond develops between a mother and a child over 3 months. But they took me without a buyer leave from her. She didn't know where I was going, who I was going to. And as you know, babies went to America. They went to England. They went everywhere. She never got anything like a photograph or an opportunity to find out if I was okay. You know, yes, there's a sting. Yes, there's anger. The system played dice with my fate and with my mother. And, you know, I don't hold the people of Ireland responsible, by the way. I take a different road to the Taoiseach. I know exactly who was responsible. It was the church, it was the state, and it was my grandparents. Not the ordinary people, those three pillars of society. So it's a lot to put into a small poem, but that's it.
When Pope Francis came to Ireland, you made your feelings known.
Well, I'm sure Pope Francis doesn't care about my feelings, but I went to Tuam to be with Catherine Corliss and to stand in that garden and be with the people that I come from, to be with the children, the babies that were buried in Tuam. That could just as easily have been me in different circumstances. You know, if my birth mother hadn't gone to Castle Pollard, she might just as easily have gone to Tuam. If something had gone wrong the night she gave birth to me, they might have also wrapped my body up and put it into a septic tank. And that's what I would like to see happen. Instead of an apology from the state, I would like to see justice for those children and their families, that their remains would be given as much of an identification as is possible scientifically, and that they would be given a dignified burial. And that would happen in all of those homes in the grounds where those children are buried and where the mothers are buried. And that's what I think those little children, those babies deserve from us as a state. We couldn't do anything to help them then, But we can really do something different now. And it's about decency, you know?
Mary Call, thank you for joining us on the Leap of Faith tonight.
Thank you, Michael.
Next this evening, we first heard of the Tomb Baby scandal in an article in the Irish Mail on Sunday in 2014, written by journalist Alison O'Reilly. Alison is also the author of My Name is Bridget. Her book grew out of painstaking research by Bridget Dolan's daughter, Anna Corrigan, who's still trying to discover the fate of her two baby brothers. Alison attended the government press conference on Tuesday this week.
Alison O'Reilly from ITV News. Minister, a lot of the families of the children who died would have claimed that their death certificates were falsified and this could have led to illegal adoptions. And there's no proof of this, but also the report says it can't disprove this either. But with up to 9,000 children dead and a lot of them haven't been found, how do you know? And why weren't there other excavations done at other sites like Bessborough, where there's over 800 children dead?
Alison, we heard you asking the question there of Minister O'Gorman. Did you get an answer?
No, I didn't. And I tried to get the answer as the press conference went on. But unfortunately, that's the way it is with these things. You never really get an answer. I did hear other journalists saying a few times, sorry, you didn't answer my question. I suppose that's the nature of these things when you're pressing government ministers for direct answers about things that they just don't have the answers for, I presume. For me, you know, the first story about Tomb that went around the world and kickstarted this commission of inquiry was the story of 796 children who are, at the time, were believed to be buried in a mass grave at Tomb. We know now since April 2017 that that was confirmed. And now we're in 2021, and not only are there 796 children missing in Tomb, but also there's 9,000 from mother and baby homes all across the country. So for me, that's how the story started. That's how I would hope we would continue going till we get some answers about where exactly are those children.
And as we come to the end of the week, what's your sense about the reaction to the government report itself?
Well, I kept hearing the word whitewash from the moment that the webinar began. Survivors and families of the children who died in Tomb in particular, who I'd be very close to, they were texting me and saying, Alison, this is a whitewash. Society is being blamed. Our families are being blamed. And there seems to be no real accountability here, certainly in the language that's been used. But most of all, where are our siblings that, you know, are lost and in that mass grave? Well, they're supposed to be in that mass grave, but until it's excavated and those remains are exhumed and some sort of DNA process is established, then we just don't have those answers. So there's a huge sense of deflation, sadness, hurt. A lot of people feel let down. I do understand that there's many, many survivors who are now in the spotlight and, you know, they've got a state apology and that means an awful lot to them. But for the families looking for their children, they're lost and they're confused.
Can I go back to 2014 and for you as a working journalist, how did you come across the story in the first place or what was the impetus for you to follow it up?
I've always been very keen to highlight children's rights stories. And when that email landed in my account by Anna Corrigan, from Anna Corrigan, I read that and she said, you know, I'd like to talk to you about my two missing brothers who are believed to be buried in a mass grave full of 800 children in Tomb. Now, you know, as a journalist, you get something like that. And look, you get some of the maddest stories and you think, oh, yeah, right, whatever. But I think what struck me was how Anna wrote the email. She was very articulate, you know, really good grammar. It was structured well. But she also left her home address. And I remember thinking, OK, there's no phone number there, but there is a home address and I will reply. And if she doesn't reply, that's going to really bother me. And I'll have to follow my nose out to Clondalkin and just knock her door someday and see what's going on. So I kind of already had all these plans in my head of what I'll do if she doesn't reply. But she did reply. When we spoke on the phone, I knew instantly the story was credible, but I had to spend about 6 to 8 weeks checking every single document that she gave me. And it was Anna that put me in touch with Catherine Corliss. So Catherine had the overall picture of the 796 names, the history of the home, the local history, and Anna had the personal stories. But the big thing that struck me was that grave had been known since the 70s and 80s. And that locals in the Dublin Road housing estate were maintaining that little grave and nobody asked questions.
Why?
I don't know. I've thought about this an awful lot. And I wonder, is it just, you know, that's a little children's grave, maybe a little cleany, you know, children from the home died there. We know about them. What more is there to know about them? We're looking after the grave. It's a very Irish way, isn't it? We're looking after that grave. We're tending to it. We put flowers on it. We keep it lovely. We don't ask questions. Catherine Corliss did. She wanted to know, well, who exactly is in there? And, you know, it emerged then that two children had been playing around there. They'd fallen into this hole. It was full of tiny bones and skulls. They rang the local priest who just came down and blessed it, and it was just covered up. And you have to wonder, like, what is that all about? You know, the local priest came down. Let's just fill it in there now. Don't disturb it. Don't do anything. I put a bit of holy water on it and we leave it at that.
Alison, will you let this go ever? Can you?
No, I can't. There's missing children. So I think you'd probably be talking to me another 5 years' time. I mean, the next battle is to try and get the legislation across and put pressure on the government to make that happen and to have the tomb site excavated, because those children are in a septic tank. And I don't know if you've ever seen the images of that excavation and those tanks, but it just looks like a filthy train track, and with, you know, dark holes where babies are lying. And so they need to come out of there. And if they're never, I could live with them never being identified rather than lying there for all eternity in such a horrible, horrible place, because they were little treasures who did nothing wrong, and they deserve dignity and respect, and they deserve to be reinterred and given a proper burial. So until that happens, I think I'm in this for the long haul, and I will. I'm a very relentless person. I can't let things go when I know that a wrong has been done, particularly to children. So, yeah. I'm in it for the long run.
Journalist Alison O'Reilly, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you very much for having me.
Finally this week, Mary Steed was born in Besborough in Cork in 1960. She was among thousands of babies and children sent for adoption to the United States. Some 30 years later, Mary began her search for her birth mother, and she joins me now from her home in Virginia. Mary, can I begin by asking you, and I'm sure you've done this many times, to tell us your story?
Yes, I was born at the Besborough Mother and Baby Home in 1960. I was there with my mother, Josephine, until I was about 18 months old. So roughly December of 1961, I was then sent to the U.S. for adoption to Philadelphia, raised there by a family of Irish Catholic background. My adopted mother was first generation. And had a relatively normal upbringing there, you know, not lacking in anything. It was good by, you know, what I've heard some others relate. There are some horror stories out there. Mine was not one of those. Unfortunately, though, when I was 17, I fell pregnant myself as a senior in Catholic high school, and my adopted mother forced me to give up my daughter. So it was sort of that legacy carry on that traveled over across the pond with me. I've reunited with my daughter and with my late mother. We met back in 2002. Unfortunately, she passed in 2013, but we did have a great 12 years together.
What was the process for you in finding and searching for your own birth mother?
Well, again, I started by contacting the Sacred Heart Order. I had written and requested medical files, any information they may have on my mother, you know, whatever they could give me. And they did send back actual photocopies of the ledgers with my medical records, which actually turned out to be a very important factor in my finding out that I had been a participant in the 4-in-1, the quad vaccine trials there between 1960 and 61. But beyond that, the one sister there kept saying, well, we don't know where your mother went. We don't know anything much about her other than, and this was telling too, she said, other than that we know she was like you, were the words she used to me. So I remember that setting off an alarm bell in my head, thinking, I wonder if she was born out of wedlock too. So I did have her name. I did have my name because it was part of my immigration paperwork, and I was able to get my original birth certificate. So what I did was I had a heritage researcher in Dublin pull birth records for Josephines that were born in the relevant time period. They also told me, by the way, that they didn't know her precise age, yet her date of birth was actually written in the upper right corner of the documents that I received from them. So that was sort of interesting as well. But yeah, her birth certificate was an immediate standout because, again, there was no father data listed and the date of birth was correct, you know, based on what they had noted on the documents. However, it still took me a good while to find her because she had left Ireland. Now, again, this goes back to the point where they told me we don't know where she went. She had actually been sent by the Sacred Hearts, as were a number of women, to a hospital in Cardiff in Wales called St. Winifred's. And it was a popular pipeline for women who didn't have families to go back to. And, you know, this was an opportunity for them to go abroad. And I'm not saying that was the worst thing ever. Although while they worked there at that hospital, they were still very much under the eyes of the nuns. And some of them still felt very institutionalized, my mother included. So they knew where she went, obviously, because they had sent her there. But it's listed nowhere in her discharge information. And again, they kept telling me, we don't know where she went. So I did finally locate her, but it was an excruciating process, complicated by the fact that my mother somehow, during her upbringing, which was institutional, had been given falsified birth details. So in other words, she believed she was born in 1940 when she was actually born 1933. Finally, a friend of mine who has done a lot of research for us and helped a number of people to search for their families, she said, look, you know, I found this marriage cert and the date, month of date of birth are correct. It's just the year is wrong. And the name is right, of course, you know, it's Josephine. And sure enough, it turned out to be her. And we very carefully broached, you know, contacts, people who lived around her. We found out where she was. And as we came to find out, she had absolutely never kept me a secret. She had told both her husbands. She had married twice. Her first husband passed, and then she remarried. And it was her second husband that was initially approached with a very oblique request. You know, a woman in the U.S. thinks they might be related to your Josie. And he said, oh, that must be the baby she had in Ireland. So we knew at that point that it was not a secret, thankfully. Otherwise, I would have been very cautious and I would not have dared disrupt her life, you know, if I felt that that was something that she couldn't cope with or couldn't deal with. I do understand that need. But in this case, I was very fortunate that she was open to it. And she greeted me as though we had just been separated a week ago, the first time we spoke.
If you wouldn't mind sharing that with us as to what that meeting was like, because there must be so many layers of emotions involved.
There are, yeah. I mean, the only thing I can say, and it was the same way with my daughter, it was very natural, nothing awkward. When I first spoke with my mother by phone, again, it was like we had just spoken the week before. And we were just picking up on a thread of conversation. We didn't miss a beat. She was just over the moon, had been patiently waiting. I think she had tried actually, I think she told me after she married in 66, she and her first husband had tried to go back to Ireland just to, you know, I guess a lot of mothers thought maybe there was a vague possibility that once they became proper married ladies, that they could go back and claim us. But I think, of course, she knew I had already gone to the States, but did try to see if she could get information. And, of course, they sent her packing. So yeah, she said at that point, she just decided to sit back and she said, I know someday my clever girl will find me. And there I was on the phone with her.
Mary, in the program, would you believe you got an opportunity to retrace the journey to meet your birth mother?
Yeah, it was incredible. We flew from Dublin over to Bristol and then I took British Rail to Swindon. She lives just a couple of blocks from the rail station there. So, you know, just walking up to her front door and her coming out to greet me, it was almost like the first time we had met all over again. That any time we got together and met, it was incredible. And I was so happy to have that opportunity through the program, you know, to be able to do that. And she obviously was just as thrilled.
Let's hear that moment now.
So how are you, love?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, it's lovely to see you.
Boy, do you remember when I sent this to you and how long it took to get to you? To my ma'am, Josephine, may we never be parted again. With all my love, you've always been in my heart and on my mind. Love always, Mary Therese.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, there's the photo from Bessboro. Mm-hmm. Now, were you there when they took that?
Yeah
you were present and they took those to show to the adopted parents? Or
they were doing them when they were getting adopted.
Oh, okay, to send that to my parents. Yeah. I don't look very happy, was I? Like I was trying to ride away or something,
no,
was I?
No, you were enjoying the bike.
Oh, was I? Okay.
Yeah,
that's the photo that they sent you, correct, right?
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. I think that dress you made for me, too, I think that came over with me.
I remember when I got it, I was showing it to Les and on. He said, you stupid woman, getting rid of that lovely girl.
Oh, that's a shame. You weren't stupid. You did the only thing you knew you could do at the time.
I thought I'd rather see you with a lovely family.
Yeah, that was an outstanding opportunity on two levels. I mean, primarily it afforded me a chance to visit my mother, which I did try to do every year, but sometimes financially that wasn't possible. So, you know, just to be able to get to see her was always a treat. And secondarily, to be able to get an inside glimpse into Bessboro. I mean, I had been there before, but only on the grounds. I'd not been inside any of the buildings. So this was really moving and emotional for me to walk through the former mother's residence. We saw a bit of twitching at the curtains in the nun's residence. There were a couple still living on the property at that time in 2010. So that was interesting. But it was an incredible opportunity and I was glad I had the chance to do that.
Mary Steed, thank you. And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. Thank you for joining us. From our producer, Sheila O'Callaghan, broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and from me, Michael Cummin. Good night.